Good afternoon. We will call the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation to order. Here, the first sunny day of spring, April 6th. Remember when you're in school and the teacher, you convince the teacher to take the class outside? This would be the right day to do that. Unfortunately, we have this whole problem with recording committees and all of that kind of stuff, so, and visual cameras. And so we're stuck here in hearing room B. We are going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 324. However, I wanted to make note that Senate Bill 579 is going to be carried over to Wednesday. So if you're here on 579, we are not going to take any action on Senate Bill 579. So with that, I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 324. Jim, do you want to give us a quick overview?
Yes, Chair Starr, members of the committee, Senate Bill 324 extends provisions of the Public Contract Code of the Oregon University System and the Legislative and Judicial Departments. We have a dash one amendment that deletes the Oregon University System from the measure, so it restores the current Oregon University System exemption.
Very good. We have a short testimony list on this bill. I'm Drew Hagedorn, AGC, and Jeremy Vermillier or something like
Vermillier.
That.
Vermillier.
There we go. That's close.
Very close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, Drew Hagedorn here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors in support of Senate Bill 324. Senate Bill 324 comes to you as a little bit of a surprise from our perspective. I did not realize there were so many entities that were excluded from application of ORS Chapter 279, Oregon's Public Contracting Code. Among them are the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and the Oregon University System. So that's why you see that proposal here before you today. The issue came to our attention over the last several years, initially with the construction or the remodel of the Capitol hearing rooms. Those bids did not go out through a competitive process. Then again, when the House and Senate wings were constructed and remodeled, that did not go through a competitive bid process, which is a public policy that we believe is very important. And then most recently, the work that was done to construct the Oregon University of Oregon, a new indoor sports arena, the legislature approved in 2008 publicly backed bonds to support that project, and that project also was not let through a competitive process. So that brought us here today with Senate Bill 324. Our intent is not to capture procurement of goods and services. Rather, our focus here is on public improvement contracts, public works contracts. So that's sort of the scope of what we are looking at. The bill that's before you may be overly broad in that regard, and we'll take steps to narrow that if that's something that's necessary. In addition, we met throughout the first part of the legislative session with the Oregon University System to work on some compromises with them. They have a very robust public contracting program that's separate and distinct from the code. And our focus really was on the sole sourcing of the project on the University of Oregon project. So we've looked to them to help us with the administrative rulemaking process, and I think you may hear from them later this afternoon. With that, I would like to conclude my remarks and turn it over to Jeremy Vermillier, legal counsel to AGC. He's an expert on Oregon's public contracting code, and he's going to talk a little bit about why we believe the contracting code is a very important public policy for Oregon and give you a little bit of background on how the code operates.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I've been asked to provide a little bit of context and general guideline with respect to how our procurement code or public contracting code work. And I thought I'd start just by backing up and giving a little bit of history. The code as we have it today has evolved over decades, and the principles underlying public contracting in general have evolved over decades, and going all the way back to the Civil War when there was rampant fraud raised in the procurement of contracted goods and services for the war effort. We developed the False Claims Act at the federal government level, and over time, states and the federal government have developed the federal acquisition regulations and individual state procurement codes, such as the ones we have in ORS 279A, B, and C. There's really three basic principles underlying public contracting. One is to ensure the integrity of the process and reduce the possibility of favoritism, corruption, fraud, and waste. Two is to produce an economically efficient product delivery, in other words, provide the government with the least cost available for the product or service that's being procured. And then three is to provide an equal opportunity to the public to obtain the benefit of government contracting. Now, those principles are embodied in ORS 279A, and they're also embodied in ORS 279C in the following respects. 279A.015 talks about ensuring a modern procurement system, talks about instilling public confidence and ensuring fairness, honesty, and good faith in the procurement of public products and public contracting. Talks about efficiency in the delivery of and in the cost of the product. Talks about impartiality and openness in the process. And it also requires the evolution of procurement methods while preserving competition. So, for example, for a number of years, we had a system whereby the public works contracts were procured by the so-called least cost or competitive bid process, which is your traditional design bid build, where the lowest bid gets the contract. Over time, we've seen design build develop. We've seen CMGC procurement methods develop, which still provide for competition, but give the agencies a little bit more flexibility in how they procure, how they evaluate the competitive proposals being submitted by contractors. So the code, as currently written, accounts for a process that allows for that kind of flexibility for the agency. It also provides for alternatives to competitive bidding in that the agency that's going to decide not to use a competitive bid process has to make public findings, has to determine that an alternative procurement delivery method is unlikely to encourage favoritism, is going to result in substantial cost savings to the agency, and they're allowed in times of emergency to promptly execute a contract to remedy the situation giving rise to emergency. So the way our code is currently written, we have a lot of flexibility to account for different delivery methods, modern techniques in terms of how projects are constructed, how they're designed, and also to account for emergencies, so long as the process laid out in statute is followed. So the question is then, what happens when the process breaks down? You get higher prices to the public. You get potentially damage to the public trust in terms of the integrity of the system and the perception of fairness, the perception of equality, or appearances of impropriety or favoritism where a competitive process is not followed. And finally, you deny the opportunity for qualified contractors to participate in the contracting process, and you deny them the opportunity to take part in the benefit of public contracting. So ultimately, what AGC is here to reiterate today is the importance of the principles that underlie the public contracting process. We want to ensure that the process continues to have integrity and that the public continues to believe that it has integrity. We want to ensure that the public is getting the least cost for the products and services and public works that the public is purchasing. We want to ensure that the process is impartial and avoids the appearances of impropriety. And we want to ensure that there are equal and open opportunities to obtain the benefit of public contracting to all qualified contractors. And with that, I'll conclude and ask if any of you have any questions.
Okay, I appreciate the testimony. One quick question for me. Is there in AGC's, I guess, frame of reference here, representing contractors, an opportunity, or does it make sense ever to exempt these exempted agencies, that there's a reason why they should go this direction, or is it the policy that every time they should, you know, basically put these projects out for public bid?
Well, I think our position, and I'm going to defer somewhat to Drew Hagedorn, but essentially the legislation arose out of the concern that there was not, particularly with respect to the OUS project and also the legislative process with respect to the remodel of the Capitol building, that there was not an overarching process in place to ensure competition. The code does provide for, in circumstances where it's appropriate, for exemption from the competitive process. So it's not so much to say that there should never be that opportunity. It's to say that there should be a standard against which those evaluations are made, and there is a statutory standard in ORS 279C. That standard doesn't exist, for example, with respect to the judiciary. Doesn't exist, for example, with respect to the legislature. So, you know, there are times when it's appropriate not to go through that kind of a process, but there's enough flexibility in the existing statute to provide for that, but also ensure that there's the process of findings and an open and transparent type of process.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Virgin.
Chair, I'm not sure that I understand why you have to go through this to accomplish exactly the list that you've given me, whether it's fairness or efficiency or encouraging competition or integrity of the system. What in the world would tell me that today we don't have that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger. We do have that insofar as our public contracting code, ORS 279C in this case, applies. We believe the code is an excellent piece of statute. AGC worked very diligently in 2003 to revise and update the code so that it separated public procurement from public improvement projects. That was a very key piece of legislation this body approved. So that's one component. We believe the code as it is today works. The problem from our perspective is that many public entities aren't subject to the code. The legislative branch, as we mentioned, and the OUS, as well as the judicial branch. So that our notion is that there isn't, insofar as the OUS is concerned, there is a process in place, a robust process, and that's why we've agreed to the -1 amendments to extract them from that, and we're going to deal with our concerns in that context administratively. However, with the OUS, with the legislative branch in particular, there really was no process that we could see at all when the work was let for the remodel of the hearing rooms as well as the two wings. And so that's when it kind of raised the issue in front of our members, and we decided that we needed to take a closer look at that. We didn't see that there was a public policy rationale for not having the legislature subject to the code, and so that's why we brought forward this proposal.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
Why do you think those entities were exempt?
Jim? Well, there's with respect to the university system, it was exempted because of, as I understand it, they had the ability to develop their own set of rules, and they had a process whereby they wanted essentially to have the ability, without going through DAS under the model public contracting rules, to write their own rules and develop a procurement process that made sense for the university system. With respect to the other agencies, or with respect to the other branches, I think probably the answer to that is because they are not agencies of the state of Oregon, they are actually separate branches, and there was just a blanket exemption given to those other two branches, the judiciary and the legislative.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add, the OUS was extracted from the code prior to the 2003 reforms, and as I mentioned, the code really did have some issues. Procurement was kind of goods and services sort of wrapped in with procurement of public improvements. It didn't really function very well. It was difficult to understand. So that was the public policy rationale for at that time removing the OUS from the code. Since then, in 2003, as I mentioned, we've updated and modernized that code so that it's much simpler to comply with and to understand and to work within.
Senator Schrader.
Senator Verger asked the exact question I was going to ask, and what's the institutional history of why these entities were not under the umbrella of the code, and I think you answered it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. You might stay close just in case there's follow-up as we hear other testimony. Let's have Lisa Pinheiro from OUS.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Pinheiro with the Oregon University System. Pinheiro, yes. I am here to let you know that we do definitely support the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 324. We have been working with AGC for the last couple of months to address the concerns that they had that initiated this bill, us, our inclusion in the bill, and I believe we've reached some understanding of the true concerns that they have over the sole sourcing provisions in our contracting code or in our contracting statute. And we will address those concerns, continue to work with them in the next couple of months, and accomplish reaching some conclusions with them through administrative processes, probably within our fiscal policy manuals in the system, that will, in fact, create some standards for when sole sourcing is appropriate within the university system.
Are there questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Scott Burgess.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Scott Burgess, Legislative Administrator for the Legislature. Right off the bat, let me make it clear that the agency is neutral on the bill, here to provide information to you. Obviously, the bill does apply, would apply the Public Contracting Code to the legislative as well as the judicial branch, and my understanding now, not the Oregon University system with the Dash 1 amendment. Legislative Administration Committee, of course, would represent one of those departments of the legislature that would be affected by this bill. Although exempt, currently LSC usually does follow the public contracting code. Examples I provided in my written testimony. Of course, I was not here in the Civil War, and quite frankly, there was Mr. Collum, although that remains to be seen. But my recollection, or at least the data that I have, was that the hearing rooms were invitation to bid. The limited research indicates some of the questions previously of why the legislature was exempted. Go back at least since 1977 as it relates to state purchasing under the code. Obviously, it was clearly exempted in 2003. It may go back as far as 1958. Limited research there. Why? Best guess would be, in fact, issue of separation of powers in terms of the derivation of the issues. But I'd also submit that there are aspects of the legislative branch being unique, given the pressures of legislative session. Going through the code, some cases would reduce the flexibility necessary to deal with those demands. Subjecting legislative departments to public contracting code may, and I emphasize may, result in higher costs, only to the degree that because we have to respond quickly to the legislature to make sure this building can function on your behalf so that you can get your work done, causing overtime, weekend work, and potentially litigation if there's some question in terms of our work. I did provide some examples. Let me use another example that's been spoken to and which I think all of you are well aware of, and that's the restoration project, which was funded some $34 million. That was approved sort of the last days of the legislature, much like always in terms of the budget process, but specifically for the legislative branch. It was a very large project, and clearly it had to be done before session started. And therefore, as a result, because it was last-minute knowledge that we had the funding to move forward, even though it had been on the people's ideas for a number of years, we actually had the legislation to move forward. We did, through sole source, pick and because of essentially a declaration of an emergency, moved forward and hired and selected a general contractor, construction manager. And that's the only part in terms of what we did. Everything else in terms of the trades and specific tasks all were bid on that project. The construction manager, general contractor, 5% of the project, 10% if they did limitation on the work that they could do. But again, all the other aspects of that large project were competitively bid. The bill as written would allow, is my understanding, to adopt its own rules if, in fact, were passed and not come under the DAS administrative rules, which I believe is appropriate given separation of powers and the unique aspects of the legislature. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Very good. Other questions for Mr. Burgess?
So just for clarification, Mr. Burgess, despite the fact that the legislature or the legislative body was exempt from this process, there were pieces of public bidding process that were followed just as a normal course of action.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, yes. I mean, often we do follow the public contracting code, and the where we have not is provided in the code in terms of emergency procedures or sole sourcing where it's necessary. And I think the previous testimony indicated some of those examples, and I gave you the one in terms of the restoration project. We needed to move. We needed to get you folks back in the building and operational in time for session. And, you know, another example is we had a fire. That was an unusual situation. It was definitely an emergency. These rooms were not, not functional, and we needed to get that done quickly in time. Unfortunately, the second floor of the governor's suite is still not put back together, but we couldn't do that and still carry out the session. So that's been, on hold.
Just if the public contracting rules had been followed with the wing remodel, what kind of timeline would that have put the project on, and as it relates to trying to get us back in? I mean, how much time was saved by basically going to the emergency declaration route?
Again, it's hard to know, but the guess would be maybe 6 to 8 weeks additional work. And I might say in the fire, we did a modified aspect, even with the general contractor, where we actually did a competitive process. It wasn't exactly as outlined in the model code, but we wanted to move quickly because it was an emergency. We went out on the street, asked for people who had those qualifications unique to this building as a historic structure, the size of the structure, and the speed. Ended up with four that we evaluated and picked them. So it was a competitive process. But
Senator Berger, any questions?
Well, I guess that it rather comes down to whether we think that the legislative branch should be connected to the code and be just like everybody else and not different from everybody else. And some of the things that come in mind, Mr. Burgess, which you came in at a time that it was on its way, and so I just, you're in a different position really than you were had you been there from the early part. So this is no disparagement at all in what I say to you personally. I think what we see in today's society is this shrinking of the private sector. And we see it all over Oregon, but I certainly see it in my district. And when you start seeing the shrinking of the private sector that employs people and provides jobs, and that goes away, then you've got this list of people that are now coming for state services because that's what they have to do to have their family. So I think it's an economic decision, a philosophical decision, and a lot of other things. So I think that's behind the bill. So I think the bill will take a lot of thought from my personal vantage point as a legislator as to how I think that works out in trying to balance the private sector of business people that are the economic engine for the state and not have the state the economic engine. So,
yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, certainly it really is a discretionary issue on behalf of the legislature. Again, my position is neutral. We're just here to implement the direction of the legislature. I wasn't here. Mr. Collum, facilities manager, certainly was here for the restoration project and several projects before that. So if there are any specific questions on any of those, I tried to give you some examples in terms of what went out for bid and what did not. And those are sort of the larger construction projects in some cases. Obviously, we do purchasing as well on behalf of the legislature. And so we deal with the code in that way as well. We certainly are not have any intention of trying to duplicate or supplement our staff. We do rely on the private sector to get the best project. We look for the best people to do the best work, and so we do that. And I think that the reality of the world is that they're quote public projects because we're here. But we need those trades in order to produce those. So I don't see that as really a conflict in terms of private and public. I, of course, was in the contracting business just before I came here for 5 years and dealt with the bidding process as well. So I understand those issues. And, again, I don't think it's our desire to avoid using private sector, use competitive, getting the best price, best product. Again, we just wanted to present to you some of the situations that we have to deal with that may be unique to the legislature. Again, it becomes, I think, a philosophical position.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to that? You're absolutely right. And besides that, the exemption was in place. So, I mean, the state did what they were allowed to do. The bill is coming. Wondering if that's a good thing for the future.
Correct.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. We have two more folks that I've identified themselves wanting to testify on this bill, Cindy Robert and Marshall Koba. Again, we're in a public hearing on Senate Bill 324.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, here this afternoon representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon in support of Senate Bill 324. We appreciate this opportunity to present our position, what we believe is a very important policy question for the state. Among the many contract provisions that this bill extends to the Oregon University System and other agencies, it requires the qualification-based selection when selecting or procuring design professionals for projects funded through these agencies. We strongly support the expansion of QBS, as it's called, qualification-based selection. It has become the model procurement method for professional design services across the country and is a proven procurement method. The expansion of QBS to more public works projects in Oregon will ensure better projects through the design and construction phase, as well as the operation and maintenance lifecycle of the project. Current law in Oregon requires QBS to be used for all state procurements of design professionals, except with limited exemptions, and for local governments to use the QBS procurement process when the total cost of a project exceeds $900,000 and at least 10% of that is state funds. The state funding can come in the form of a grant, a loan, and includes the highway fund. And while this was a significant step in the right direction, we found there are a number of projects that are not under this requirement, and a notable exemption, as we're seeing here in Senate Bill 324, are the three agencies listed here. QBS, I'd like to share with you two thoughts from well-respected and well-known organizations. First, the American Bar Association is very supportive of the qualification-based selection process, as is the American Public Works Association, which are the day on-the-ground professionals working in the procurement of design professionals. And if I can, from their statement, the APWA believes that the public interest is best served when governmental agencies select architect, engineers, and related professional technical consultants for projects and studies through QBS procedures. Basing selections on qualifications and competence rather than price fosters greater creativity and flexibility and minimizes the potential for disputes and litigation. QBS engineering and architectural services are unique. There's no question about that. And they are procured differently than other services and other project phases. When an engineer enters into a project, the scope of the work has not been entirely defined. Therefore, there are no specific parameters on which to base a price estimate. Price bidding only works when there is a clearly specified scope, such as the construction phase. There's long-term savings because of the life cycle costs. Even though the fee for a design professional amounts to only a small percentage of a total project cost. The result of their design can greatly impact over the life cycle, which, as we all know, oftentimes is 50, 60, 70 years for buildings or bridges. Safeguards the public interest, and it encourages competition, as it is the most competitive and open form of federal procurement, and we believe state procurement, possible. In summary, the main advantage of the qualification-based system is that it is the design professional and the client work in a collaborative spirit to maximize the quality, value, cost-effectiveness, and usefulness of the final product. Design professionals believe strongly that their services should be selected on the basis of qualifications and competence. This widely accepted method, adhered to by the federal government in more than 35 states, provides for vigorous and open competition among design firms in areas of personnel experience, prior performance, and technical skills. Using QBS can assure the acquisition of the most capable professional while at the same time obtaining a price that is fair and reasonable to the client. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Robert?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the American Institute of Architects. I'm often accused of speaking too fast, too loud, and sitting next to my friend, Mr. Koba, I have decided I'm okay. I was up there. I want to break this down really simply in how we see it at the American Institute of Architects. We have three parts to our contracting code in Oregon, 279A, 279B, 279C. The procurement services for architects and engineers, all design services, are under 279C. This bill, including having all public procurement apply to the legislative, judicial, and university systems, would also make that 279C, the procurement of architects and engineers, apply to those three branches as well. Now, Mr. Burgess from Legislative Administration just spoke to you about the fact that they have, in fact, been able to use for the legislature qualification-based selection and procurement processes that were not based on low bid. And I would like to share with you to add to this conversation about why, in fact, the judicial and legislative branches should be using QBS, the following information. In the fall of 97, the legislature put out an RFP for master plan development services for the Oregon Capitol. That RFP requested bids of which 30% of your score was based on how much you bid. In 1997, when the legislature decided that for all other state agencies, QBS was the most effective way to get high-quality work, I have no idea why they would decide, and Senator Verger asked why was there an exemption, I have no idea why they would decide it was good for the rest of the state and the rest of the state agencies, but not them. But as Mr. Burgess pointed out, they in fact do follow some of the rules because they do realize it's better for them. This would just simply codify what in a lot of cases they're doing. In 2007 on this master plan RFP, when we spoke to Dave Henderson, who was then the administrator, about the process and the Capital Administration Committee, they said, you know what, you're right. QBS is a better process for selection and procurement of design services. We should, in fact, be using it here. Now, the RFP had already been sent out, so what did they do? They automatically gave the 30 points, the 30% total score, to everyone who just simply responded with the price, thus fulfilling all the requirements of the RFP, but not having looked at the price at all. So that plan and that RFP was selected based on QBS. Again, it's the legislature acknowledging it's the right way to do it. They have the state do it. They have themselves do it. Might as well codify it so everyone does it as they should.
Very good. Thank you very much. Are there questions for either one of these witnesses? I don't see any. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else in the audience that didn't sign up that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 324? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 324. We will likely come back to that bill at some point in time. Moving ahead, we've got we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 779. I believe that Jim and Aaron
we're gonna
switch spots. A number of individuals signed up to testify in 779, so I just want to be cognizant of the time. Erin, would you like to just give a brief overview of the bill?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 779 increases the number of video lottery terminals that may be placed on premises of race meet licensees. It increases it from 10 to 40. You do have a Dash 1 amendment that would increase it to 30 instead of 40.
Very good. Athena Douglas. And if you have anyone that wants to join you.
Good afternoon, members of, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Athena Douglas. I'm a lobbyist here with my client today, the Oregon Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, and we are in full support of Senate Bill 779, as written or with the dash ones as we requested. Would you like my colleague to introduce himself or for me to just...
Just go ahead and...
Okay. Over the years, since the Oregon lottery has started up and started using video poker, we've seen a drop in people betting on horse races, and it has dramatically hurt our industry. So we've decided that over the years, we have tried other methods of supplementing our purse accounts, and on the third page you can see in there some of the things we've done as an off-track betting site and a wagering hub that's based in Oregon that we have a small tax on, and that has helped, but we just cannot keep up with the Oregon Lottery and the Indian gaming casinos, and we'd like just to try a few more video lottery machines to supplement our purse account. If our industry goes away, we lose a lot of jobs in Oregon, and I might point out that many of those jobs are unskilled laborers, and they will probably be looking for assistance. But if we can keep this going, a lot of those people keep working. They don't look for assistance. They move forward on their own. Do you have any questions?
Let's go ahead and have, is it Mr. Cartney?
Yes, Dick Cartney.
Yes, if you want to testify, then we'll see if there's questions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think Ms. Douglas pretty well stated our case. We're here in support of Senate Bill 779, primarily because of our concern about the future of the horse racing industry in Oregon. As she mentioned, we've been through a pretty significant steady decline in revenue stream, and we attribute a considerable amount of that to the increased competition from Native American casinos and also the video lottery terminals that are placed around the state. So we have a lot of folks. I know I have in our organization, we have 1,600 members, owners and trainers of thoroughbred racehorses in the state of Oregon. They all employ a considerable amount of people. They buy goods and services, and we would like to continue to have our industry survive. But unfortunately, the economics are such that our expenses are running well ahead of our revenue. So we're at the point now where we feel like we need to have some support to continue to be a viable industry, and we would like to keep people employed, and so we would appreciate any support we could get from the legislature.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator George?
Thank you. Both of you, when you look at this, even if we did the 30, have you guys done calculations based off of what you think the enhanced revenue would be, and this is enough to make the industry viable? With?
Go ahead. That was a difficult, we'd like to have 1,000 or more, but we realize that that's not practical and it's probably not sustainable for us at this time. It would make a significant impact on our revenue stream, both for our purse account and some for the track operator who needs to be in business or we won't have a place to race. So we feel like it would be a good start, and we'd like to try this and see how it works. And it certainly will be a help. I can promise you. I think last in 08, I think our share of the to the horsemen was approximately $50,000. So I think if we could move up to 30, it would definitely be a real significant step in the right direction in replacing some of the revenue that we've lost over the years.
Thank you.
Senator Verger.
What year did you get legislative approval to get 10?
You know, I do not have the answer to that. I believe there may be a gentleman in the audience. Mr. Dave Nelson, I think, was involved in that. It's, but it's been in recent years, I would say, within the last 5 years.
I know I voted on it, so.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Rob Douglas and Wendy Hayes Pound.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, here today representing the Oregon Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. Joan Buck and myself have had the pleasure of representing these people for 31 years. It is a relationship that we value very highly. Paramutual wagering on horses was the first form of wagering licensed by the state of Oregon. We think it's an important part of the agricultural community, and we think it should be preserved. But we are not just completely altruistic about this. Without a viable commercial race meet, there is no market for our product. Breeders do not have a way to sell into a market if there is no big commercial horse racing meet. And we think this will help purses. That's why we urge you to vote yes on Senate Bill 779.
Chair Starr, Commissioners, in representing, my name is Wendy Hayes Pounds, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders Association. And representing the breeders of the state of Oregon, it is very important that our product have a viable race meet to move our product to. Without that, there is no need for the horses being bred in this state, the acreage supporting those that pay tax revenues, and also the operators that employ laborers and buy goods and services in the state of Oregon that support our Oregon's.
Very good. That's great. Questions? Questions for either witness? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. We have Justin Martin, Michael Mason, and Craig Dorsey representing the tribes. Grand Ronde, Warm Springs, and Siletz, respectively.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. And I'm also proud to be the association manager for the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance. I will make some quick, brief points today. We have a representative from Western Valley Tribe in Grand Ronde, an Eastern Tribe in Warm Springs, and then Mr. Dorsey, who is also the chair of the legal committee for the Tribal Gaming Alliance. So it should give you a nice, quick perspective. Thank you for the opportunity to be in front of you today. We are here in opposition to Senate Bill 779, and let me start by saying we certainly don't want to see racing in Oregon go away. We are here to argue about this issue on another point. First and foremost, to give you guys a little bit of context, the expansion of video lottery terminals here in Oregon is not needed. Currently, there's nearly twice the amount of video lottery terminals for the Oregon State Lottery as there is with all nine tribes combined. Specifically, it's 12,272 video lottery terminals for the lottery as opposed to 7,577 for the tribes, all nine tribes combined. That's about a 38% share of the market. While Senate Bill 779 is specific to a site, we believe that expansion in lottery in Oregon would lead to continued actions across the gaming spectrum, and this policy would start to consider a slippery slope. We heard in the earlier testimony that the reality is 30 machines might not solve those problems. We saw in 2005, 6 went to 10. We're seeing in 09, 10 goes to 30. What will we see in the future? 30 to 50, 50 to 100, to 200, potentially 1,000, as was mentioned earlier. Again, we want to separate the racetrack from this specific policy. So again, we feel amongst the nine tribes in Oregon that this could be a slippery slope leading to even more gambling expansion in Oregon. Quickly, a February 2009 study showed that Oregonians, 82% of Oregonians, feel that there is just the right amount of gaming currently in Oregon between the lottery and between tribal gaming. 46% of that thought it was just right. 36% of that thought it was too many. And only 5% of the Oregon electorate thought that we had too few options. Another quick note, I also sit on the Oregon Council for Problem Gambling. We are seeing ourselves on the cut list when it comes to treatment, prevention, and support services for problem gambling here in the state of Oregon. That is very unfortunate. We hope that those programs and services do not get cut, but we also believe that a policy of any gambling expansion that could lead to more in the future would not be in line, again, with those cuts for problem gambling services. So finally, the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance, which is a consortium of all nine tribes that offer gaming here in Oregon, is also opposed to this bill. So thank you again for this opportunity to testify, and you will be hearing from two attorneys next to me. Hopefully they will be brief. Again, we appreciate this opportunity. Please oppose Senate Bill 779.
Thank you. Mr. Mason, do you want to proceed?
Thank you, Chair Starr and members of the Business and Transportation Committee. For the record, my name is Michael Mason. I represent the Federated Tribes of the Warm Springs. As Justin has pointed out a few times, I actually hired him to work for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde when I was tribal attorney there. So I actually played a role there in the development of Spirit Mountain Casino, which I'm proud of. There's a couple of problems with 779. I want to say from the outset, of course, the tribes don't oppose horse racing. They support horse racing. The tribes were the first to do horse racing in Oregon. I mean, if you look out, you know, at the Cayuse and the Nez Perce with the Appaloosa, I mean, this is a long and treasured history. However, there's a couple of differences here between the way, like a new tribal casino would have to be set up and the process here for creating a mini casino, so to speak, at the tracks. You know, having been involved with the process at Cascade Locks for 9 years, it's been about a 7-year environmental process. We're doing a full-blown environmental impact statement. We're not objecting to that. That's the game. That's the law. It's the National Environmental Policy Act. Even a small casino like this would require, like the one proposed, would require an environmental assessment under the National Environmental Policy Act if a tribe were doing it. And that's really regardless of location. You know, on reservation, off reservation. So there would have to be that environmental assessment. That would look at every possible effect or impact on the human environment. And it is not, even an environmental assessment is not a brief process, and it needs to go on for about a year to make sure you get all the public input. What's one thing that's concerning in terms of fairness on this is if you were to go ahead and pass this law, no one in the vicinity of the track would be able to weigh in. And that's one of the things that, as a person residing in Portland, somewhat concerns me. If a bar is opening, the tavern's opening, they apply for a license, I can actually say something about that as someone living in the neighborhood. But if once they open, they decide to have six machines, I have no say over that. I probably don't even know it's happening. In fact, I've seen it happen in a neighborhood I live in without any ability to weigh in at all. There's no local option. There's no real local input about that kind of thing. So a couple of items that are different from in the process. Now, there was a comment about 1,000 VLTs. Well, we get to a point, and I think we reach that point with 40, where you run up against the Oregon Constitution. Now, granted, you know, this body
you know, the Senate and the House of Representatives are the first interpreters of the Oregon Constitution. You're making the laws. You're saying, well, we're going to pass this law, and it means if we pass this that we don't think that 30 machines or 40, whatever you do, is a casino that flies in the face of the prohibition on the Legislative Assembly creating casinos, which was put into effect when the lottery was expanded back in, I want to say 1990, though I was in Washington, D.C. then, working with the Bush-Lujan administration, in the Department of the Interior, so I might have the year wrong. But I think it was 89-90, it was somewhere in there. If that's the interpretation, I mean, that's something to think seriously about. When do you get to a point that you actually are running up against that constitutional prohibition? It's not 10. We can agree with that. 10 machines. But it sure looks like you're getting there with 30 or 40. So, great. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Dorsey.
Yes, thank you. I'll be real brief, too. Just to echo Michael, we're really here because of the policy concerns that this bill raises about edging closer to the definition of a casino, which is said in the Ecumenical Ministries case. Revenues from the state lottery and the line games have been increasing year by year. The revenue taken in by the bars and taverns increased dramatically once the line games were put into play and the machines were increased to 6, and this gets closer to that line. The percentage that Indian tribes take in their casinos has actually been declining, and the state's share of revenue has been increasing in the last 4 or 5 years since line games were increased. The number of slot machines that the state has been increasing pretty steadily over the last 4 or 5 years. The number of slot machines that the tribes provide has remained flat. So the tribes' revenue has actually been dropping by a percent or two every year. Indian tribes are allowed to engage in casino-type activities because of the Federal Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which allows them to offer the same types of games that the state does. We also have a policy in place at the moment that we've agreed to with the state. All of the tribes have what the state calls destination resorts, where all their casinos are outside the urban areas. That's a policy that has worked pretty well for all the tribes. But once we start looking at offering more and more machines in an urban setting, that may also work to start reopening that subject for discussion with Indian tribes, too. We've been concerned about the possibility of the casino at the Multnomah Kennel Club and some of the other options that have been offered over the last years. So I just think this is a much bigger issue than it looks like in just doing 30 machines. As the other two witnesses have said, we don't oppose horse racing at all, but this isn't horse racing. It's obtaining revenue through another guise. And so we'd urge you to oppose this proposal.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Other questions for Senator Berger?
Well, I think this is a delicate subject to approach with you, but let me see how I do. The casino in North Bend expanded, doubled in size, handled beautifully. Many public hearings, walked the public through it, signage for where you could park when it was under construction. They have done a fabulous job in integrating into the community there with a lot of pushback in the beginning when it was going to be built. However, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe the public had any real say in whether you could expand on your own property. Is that right?
Yeah, as a general rule, that's correct. The compact that the tribes have with the state of Oregon provides for a process for public input. Also, let's say in the Coquille situation, they acquired additional land, which was put in trust. Any proposal economic development or otherwise by an Indian tribe, because the land is owned by the federal government, falls under the Federal Environmental Policy Act and has to go through that process. In addition to acquire the land in trust, there is a public comment and participation process where the local government and the state are all permitted to provide comments, and that's all part of the process also. So I would say that there is a large amount of public input, as Michael talked about, that the Warm Springs proposed casino in Cascade Locks has had been going through that process for 7 years and is not anywhere close to completion.
Okay. I think my point was that the public, follow up, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. that the public didn't have a say in whether it could be done or not.
That's correct. The tribes are separate sovereigns.
Yes.
Their membership so the public, makes that decision.
But while I want to commend the process that was done, in the final analysis, that process could have been done, and the public hearings would have all said, no, we don't like it, and still could have expanded, is kind of where I am. So you do fall under the EIS, however.
Certainly when casinos are constructed to begin with, yes. And then any change or alteration in use of a policy has to at least go through the FONSI and environmental assessment process.
I'll have other comments.
Mr. Mason, do you have a comment to that?
Well, Chair and members of the committee, I just wanted to say FONSI is not a reference to an old TV sitcom. It's the finding of no significant impact. You're probably all aware of that, but just for the record, it's
we
finding of no significant impact under the National Environmental Policy Act.
We appreciate that. Thank you. Senator George?
Gentlemen, I think the most important argument you made here is a slippery slope argument up towards the constitutional limit. So that resonates with me. But at the same time, if we look out there and we look at this particular industry, and I think about the situation we had with, I know it's slightly different, but the kennel, the Multnomah Kennel Club, and loss of that entire industry. But this industry is huge in the state of Oregon. I mean, I've got a lot of breeders in my district who are in my district who need this type of infrastructure. Is there? I do know that that we only have one licensee, racer licensee, that currently has veto terminals. Let's face it, that's Portland Meadows at this point. They really are under financial pressure, and I don't think that since we're limited just to them, is there some way that we can come up with something, maybe some kind of definitive statement that we're not going to be going to 1,000 terminals at that point, that we give them, that licensee, some kind of additional break, because we don't want to break over that point where we put them out of business. I mean, clearly, we made policy decisions both on the Oregon Lottery, and then you all made policy decisions with the casinos, which are a great addition to our state, but that has negatively impacted that institution of Portland Meadows. I mean, the difference between Portland Meadows today and Portland Meadows 20 years ago is dramatic. And we've all sucked from them over the last 20 years. Is there some way we can come up with some compromise to give them a little something extra to see if we can't keep this industry alive in the state of Oregon? Is there some middle ground that you guys could come to that would, since it is just one licensee?
I guess my first response is I don't know that I'm authorized to say anything on behalf of my client on that point. I would say generally that as I said, the state lottery is also a bigger player than the tribes on this subject. One of the other concerns I know I've had is, for example, there was a proposal before the Oregon Racing Commission last year about doing machines that we believed, and I think the state believed, were slot machines. They were instant racing machines. And our concern, especially on those, was that once you open the door at Portland Meadows, then you have all these off-track betting parlors, which would also say, well, we're just the off-track version of this, and all of a sudden you're looking at a proliferation of OTB parlors around the states that are really mini casinos. So it's a difficult issue. It's something that certainly should be looked at, but it's hard to figure out all the ramifications right now, and I know there's a lot of them from our perspective.
Senator Schrader.
Is there some threshold above which, and I don't know if this is in statute or not, so forgive my not knowing this, above which a number of machines at one technically becomes a casino? Is there some threshold? I mean,
the Oregon Supreme Court in the Ecumenical Ministries case, there is a definition which is it's 50% of revenue. If the dominant purpose of an establishment is gaming, then it's a casino, and an establishment includes a room or other space. So that's what they started with. I have back in my bag, there is a regulation under the lottery, which is their definition of casino, which fudges on that a little bit. It looks at 50% as the starting place of lottery-based income versus non-lottery-based income, but also looks at a variety of other factors like was it traditionally a family restaurant? How much of the percentage of the floor space devoted to lottery machines? What kind of advertising they have? How clean the establishment is? That they're looking at from a regulatory standpoint. But Ecumenical Ministries is pretty straightforward, about 50%.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it today.
Thank you.
We had one more request for the testified date. Oh, actually two more. And let's just have you both come up together, Dave Nelson and Dale Penn, the last two folks that have identified themselves as wanting to testify. And Dave, why don't you go first and we'll hear from the agency director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dave Nelson. I am a quarter horse breeder. I lobbied this institution from 1969 through the summer of 08 and represented Portland Meadows from 1976 through 2007. Been a member of the Quarter Horse Board of Quarter Horse Racing Association Board of Directors from 1971 through today, and served as the chairman from 1973 through 96. Currently a member of the Racing Committee of the American Quarter Horse Association, where I've been for 16 years, and then was elected member of the Board of Directors of the American Quarter Horse Association. Served on the Governor's Task Force on Gambling in the late 1990s. And that task force did acknowledge the impact of the growth of lottery on Portland Meadows and on the racing industry in the state of Oregon. Couple of things I wanted to point out. One, the lottery was began 1984. It was begun by GTEC. They hired a guy named Hank Crawford, and they wanted to sell their services to the state of Oregon. So Hank carried a petition campaign, went to the voters. The voters approved the lottery. In that, they tossed in a couple of sweeteners that included no casino, constitutional prohibition on casinos, and a couple of other things. 1991, when Senator Kitzhaber was president of the Senate and Larry Campbell was the Speaker of the House, they decided they needed more money, so they added VLTs to the mix. And VLTs, video lottery terminals, that were video poker. And during the period from 1995 through 1997 was the greatest run-up in the number of video poker machines in the state, or video lottery gaming terminals in the state. It included the lottery and it included the Indian casinos. And that went from like zero in 91 to about 12,000 in 1998. At the same time, the horse racing parimutuel handle, that's the amount of dollars that are wagered in the state on races, dropped from $120 million a year down to about $70 million a year. Racing survives on a 20% deduction from that amount of money. So when your base goes from $120 million a year down to $70 million a year, your total operating revenue just drops out the bottom. So this bill really ought to be, so there you can see there's a direct connection between the run-up of video gaming opportunity and the tanking of racing in the state of Oregon. So this bill really ought to be looked at not just as a helpmate for the racing industry, but as mitigation for state competition and tribal competition with an industry that essentially had a franchise from the state to be an exclusive gaming place in the state from 1933 to 1991. When that all changed. So I think gambling, whenever you get into gambling, it's always the big fish and the little fish. The more attractive game is the one that And so it becomes competition back and forth between whether it's a lottery or whether it's the Indian casinos or whether it's commercial casinos. The most attractive games are the ones that draw the people. Video or slots are the most compelling gaming game that there is. That's why the tribes do well at it. That's why the Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut does $1 billion a year on their slots. It's an amazing compulsion to play the slot. So this is a very small bill. The legislature has tried to address the issue, but the governors over the, you know, Governor Kitzhaber, Governor Kulongoski have always kind of salved the conscience of the expansion of gaming argument by beating up on the racetrack, saying you can't have a few more video slots while everybody grows around them. The lottery today, I think Director Penn will confirm, has about 50% of its video terminals in Multnomah County or the Tri-County area around Portland. It's kind of like when they asked Willie Hutton or Willie Horton why he robbed banks. He said, that's where the money is. Well, that's the deal. You know, you can put your terminals in Portland, and that's where the money is. So this bill really ought to be enacted. It's a very small mitigation to the effect that this growth of gaming in Oregon has had on the racetracks and the racing industry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Appreciate the historical perspective. I think that's helpful. Are there questions for Mr. Nelson?
Actually, yes, Mr. Chair. The discussion here is sort of like and you sort of framed it this way, that there's competition over the same pot of money, but I actually view it a little different, which is there has been a growing expansion of gambling generally in the state. So really, I think that the question is where is that market? Now, clearly what's happened is that as far as Portland Meadow goes, you have got a decreasing slice of a massively growing pie.
Correct.
So I'm not sure that adding, I mean, I guess the tough thing I'm having with some of the discussion so far is I'm not sure that you're actually taking, if you added units at Portland Meadows, you're necessarily taking them from somebody else. And that's, can you expand on that a little bit?
I would, Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I think you're right. What we used to think was that there's a finite market for gambling opportunity, and I think that that's been disproved. I think that as there seems to be a growing market clear across the United States for gaming, and as more states get into the voluntary revenue business, that seems to grow more every year. And so I think that the market continues to expand. I don't know if there is a limit to it. But certainly it seems to grow. I think the tribes will report, if they reported that, they would report a continual growth in ability to expand their facilities. That takes money. That's got to come from their offerings of their products. So, yeah, we used to think that that was a limitation. I don't think that that's the case. As you said, I think obviously Portland is the holy grail of gambling opportunity, and that's why everybody wants to get close to Portland. We happen to be in Portland, or, you know, Portland Meadows happens to be in Portland, has been for a long time. And I think the opportunity there is quite unlimited. Unlimited is the wrong choice of words, but, you know, quite a bit broader than what we thought. I think it would be very little impact, if any impact, on the lottery or on the tribes.
Mr. Penn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. I'm here just to give you a little bit of information and answer any questions you might have about the proposal. We aren't taking a position in favor or opposition of it. I simply can tell you that we can supply the machines to the racetrack if your policy choice is to expand their machines. And I would modify one thing. Looking at the fiscal impact statement, we've put some costs in, and those costs were kind of based upon the idea that it would go to 40 machines. I've heard there's some discussion of having it be 30 machines. And so I'd have to say that it really should be a range, the low range of $12,000. We definitely would have to have that equipment in. But if you were going to modify this bill and say that there would be 30 machines allowed at the racetrack, I believe that we would be able to supply 20 additional machines without having to buy new stock. So really the cost at that time would be $12,000 rather than several hundred thousand dollars. So just make that clarification. So it's kind of a range. I would also say that I think everyone certainly is dealing with the difficulty of reduced revenues, and certainly the race association is in that situation. And so their purpose of looking for alternatives or ways to increase the dollars available and to maintain racing, that's certainly a laudable goal. There's been some testimony about the idea of how many machines is a casino. And I disagree a little bit with some of the earlier testimony. Unfortunately, the Oregon Supreme Court did not define the term for us. The Attorney General's office has issued an opinion that they believe that 100 machines would be a casino. So we're left with an undefined term from the Supreme Court, an Attorney General's opinion of 100, and the precise ruling of the Supreme Court in that opinion was that 5 machines in a bar was not a casino given the facts that were presented. So we know someplace between 5 and thousands, and maybe 5 and 100, we hit a line. I think one reason that the commission is asking you perhaps for 30 machines is the idea that they believe they would be sufficiently below at least the present Attorney General's opinion of 100 being a casino, and so 30 or 40 would seem to fit. The last thing I'll say is, again, the Supreme Court did not use the 50% term, and I can go into all kinds of discussion about what our rule is, and we do identify that if you have less than 50% of your revenue coming from gambling, that you would not be a casino. And then if you are more than that, then we look at a broader range of issues. That's the way our present rule is set up. But we believe this is doable. It really comes down to a policy choice by the legislature, and we'll be happy to implement it if you so choose, or if you choose not to change this number, we can continue to operate as we are.
Senator George.
One of my concerns here is that we walk down this path, but it really doesn't save Portland Meadows or horse racing in Oregon. So I don't know if you have these numbers easily, but in the revenue impact or the fiscal analysis, it says terminals currently at Portland Meadows racetrack average more revenue per terminal than the statewide average, and goes through and explains why that may or not be true. Portland Meadows has to believe that they have people waiting in line to get to these terminals, that they would be able to absorb additional. So what could Portland Meadows in this situation possibly hope revenue-wise if they were, I mean, what kind of revenue are they bringing in additional because of these machines? In essence, are we going to? Would we save Portland Meadows with 20 more machines?
Yeah.
Or is it a slippery slope?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator George, I'm really not the right person to answer that. I think the commission themselves would have to answer that. But clearly, we know when we talk about 50% of the machines, lottery machines, are in the Portland area, that's because 50% of the population is there. And so certainly there is a big audience and availability. And I think then it boils down to 10 machines if they believe there are times when those machines are overloaded, that they have players walking away, if they've observed that. Then it comes down to how much they promote their business and promote that along with their food and other things that they have. That is really going to be the key to how much money they can make in this proposal.
Follow-up? Sure. Is there any way for you to give me an idea just off the cuff of what we would expect per machine or anything like that so I get a depth perception? Because here's the thing is, I am really sympathetic to the slippery slope argument. At the same time, if this is how close we are to saving this industry, then I'm more willing to consider it. And if I had an idea of the kind of dollars we're talking per machine, is there anything that's out there that's easily accessible for me?
Well, Ms. Chair and Senator George, I'd be happy to perhaps try to work with the commission. I think it really does come back to them. You could simply multiply the number of additional machines by the average that we have supplied. Now, whether or not they can meet that or exceed it, that's where it comes into play, how you promote it, how you present it. And that's the real wild card, I think.
Thank you.
Other questions for either one of these? Seeing none, thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience wishes to testify on Senate Bill 779? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 779, and that bill may come back, may not. We'll see what happens with it. And we are going to move to the next bill on the list, a work session on Senate Bill 802. So I'll open the work session on Senate Bill 802. And Jim, can you remind us about this bill? We've had this bill up a couple times, at least.
Mr. Chairman, you heard this on the 25th of March. This is Senate Bill 802.
Right.
It allows orders for distilled liquors to be delivered directly to commission liquor stores with consent of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Creates special events distillery licenses that may be obtained by distillery license of the OLCC. It limits special events distillery licenses to period not exceeding 5 days. It requires licensees to purchase the distilled liquor for special events from the OLCC. You have the dash one amendment, which removes the direct delivery provisions. So it leaves the special events provisions in the measure.
We were waiting for a fiscal and didn't.
Yes, and you now have a minimal expenditure impact on the dash one and a no revenue.
Very good. What's the committee want to do? Any questions for Jim or anyone else on this bill? Everybody on board what we're doing?
Mr. Chair, is the consensus the dash ones?
I believe so. We accept the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 802.
The motion to amend Senate Bill 802 with the dash one amendments. Is there discussion in the dash one amendments?
I think that was the purpose of the bill, Mr. Chair. I think it just simply, they were trying to get at people being able to go off premise. Wasn't that the idea from Senator Bates?
I believe that's the case.
So it seems like the dash one focused more on the purpose of the bill.
Jim, do you want to...
Mr. Chairman, this bill originates with Senator Bates, and there was some discussion about the delivery of products to Southern Oregon, and in working with the OLCC delivery people, they worked that portion out. It was my recollection of the testimony, and that is why the dash one was brought to remove that provision, leaving the special events provision. There are manufacturers who have special events provisions, but the distillery people do not at the present time. So that was what this bill was designed to address.
Any additional comments on the motion? Objections? Seeing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I move Senate Bill 802 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 802 as amended by the dash one amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? And then so ordered. And Carrier.
Senator Bates, Carrier, do you want to have somebody from the committee? Or?
Any volunteers on the committee want to carry this bill?
Does Senator Bates?
Why don't we check with Senator Bates and see if he would like to carry. No. Otherwise, I'll carry it. And, Jim, is there anything else for the good of the order as we look forward this week?
That is all for today that I am aware of.
Okay.
I have some information on Wednesdays if you'd like.
Yes.
I've been called on that so often, and I've not been prepared. I was prepared today. So
there you go.
Senator, I didn't want you to let it go.
What happened on Wednesday, Jim?
Senate Bill 849, which is audio newspaper service. Senate Bill 600, which has to do with credit union deposits. Mm-hmm. And then we have a work session on 579, the one that was carried over from today and from last week.
Very good.
Okay.
See no other business before the committee. We're adjourned.